They've been hard to avoid lately, haven't they? The images in the media that we've been shown from Iraq, especially a couple weeks ago, those images from Fallujah. Quite a bit of controversy here in St. Louis and nationwide about whether or not newspapers, television should have shown the images of charred and mutilated and dismembered bodies of civilians, of American civilians hanging from a bridge in Iraq with Iraqis dancing around beneath them in joy and jubilation. If you saw the images, you might have been disturbed. In fact, really much for the last 3 years, we've been treated to all sorts of disturbing images, not only in our warfare against terrorism, but also in the movies as well. The images of the Passion of the Christ, obviously disturbing, but meaningful in an entirely different way. We're going to talk about disturbing images in the media here in the first 10 minutes of Issues, Etc. Amy White is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. When we finished our conversation with Amy, Arian Campo Flores, a conversation I had with him yesterday, he's from Newsweek magazine. He has written in the latest Newsweek about Christian nightclubs, the article called Get Your Praise On. We'll talk about that. And then, in the second part of this first hour, Aaron Wolf of Chronicles Magazine is our guest. Neoconservatives and Christian Zionism. The president has decided to change U.S. policy in the Middle East, not just the Middle East, but Israel and Palestine. We'll find out what Aaron thinks about that. And why is it that Israel is worth defending, if not for reasons of theology, if only for reasons of geopolitics and foreign affairs? Is there a good reason? We'll find out there in the second hour, second part of this first hour. Then in the second hour, open lines for your questions and your comments. We'll hear from the authors of the Left Behind series. They were on 60 Minutes 2 last night, Jerry Jenkins and Tim LaHaye. Get your reaction to that as well. In the third hour, from 5 to 6, Pastor Will Whedon, part six of our seven-part series on the liturgy of sickness, death, and dying. We'll talk about the committal service, the service at the graveside. That's all coming up on Issues, Etc. Amy White is our guest here for the first 10 minutes. She's a corporate and political speechwriter. She's author of a column in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch titled, Don't Turn Away. Amy, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Amy, you talk about these disturbing images that we have seen, and many people have decided they don't want to see them. They say, out of respect for the dead. You say it's not always a matter of respect. What do you mean?
No, in my viewpoint, Todd, it really isn't just a matter of respect, especially because these four American contractors who endured this disgraceful treatment at the hands of the Iraqi crowd is symptomatic of what our servicemen and women are facing in Iraq. And I felt like it was very important that we be willing to look at the reality of what's occurring in Iraq, be willing to look, quite frankly, at the evil that's present among our enemies, because this was a very evil act. And there are some who tried to talk about the Iraq conflict as if it's simply a matter of we're occupying their country and they don't want us there, and so this is why these things are occurring. It's a much more primitive reason than that. And one of the points of my piece today is that this really has deep religious roots, and I think many people are uncomfortable acknowledging that.
Does it really come down to good versus evil, Amy?
In my opinion, yes, it does. And I think that even people, aside from a religious framework, experience day-to-day in their lives the presence of both good and evil. So I don't think that this is really necessarily just a theological concept that only some are willing to accept. I think most people on a day-to-day basis in their lives see the presence of both good and evil every day.
Do you think that's at the root, perhaps that way of thinking? It's a way that's so common in our postmodern world, that good and evil are just ideas, just words. They don't have either real manifestations or any real substance to them or any objective definition. And so someone looks at mutilated bodies and they say, yeah, but we've done bad things too, so there you go. We can hardly call that evil in an objective sense.
Well, and of course, that's an outgrowth of this secular humanism that has been embraced in the United States for decades now. This idea that as long as you can come up with a reason for your action, it is neither, you know, good or evil, but simply your motivation, your experience of reality. And it's really false, and I don't think anyone's day-to-day life really bears that out.
So we need to look evil in the face. Is that the point here?
Yes, I think it's that we really have to acknowledge the nature of the conflict. I became very concerned when there was so much protest over these bodies being shown, whether it was on the front page of the Post-Dispatch or some limited footage that the cable news stations ran, because to me it's a reminder that even the terrible footage that we saw from 9/11 has been so easily forgotten. In 2.5 years, we now have people completely immersed in the minutiae of different things with the 911 commission and who knew what and was there a way to stop it, and they've completely skipped over the bottom basic root of the thing, that we were attacked, that it had hideous results, and that this is part of our response. So I think that this is just a convenient way to avoid uncomfortable realities. And unfortunately, I think many Americans are interested in going to great lengths to preserve their own comfort level. They don't want to open up their paper and see pictures of mutilated bodies of Americans. They don't want to see footage of what our soldiers are dealing with Iraq. And we also heard a lot of feedback, certainly from movie critics, certainly from some letters to the editor across the country, that no one wanted to see the Passion of the Christ.
On the issue of that movie, people will ask, why did it have to be shown in detail? You could have communicated the events, especially on film, without actually showing what that film, in terms of its graphic portrayal, showed. How do you respond?
I think that Christians and people of all different faiths may feel and react differently to the movie. My personal feeling is that if Christ was called on to pay this price, and the gospel accounts give us the timeline of what occurred, though it does treat it briefly, I think that Mel Gibson's attempt to truly bring the minute-by-minute reality, at least in some parts, to the screen is a tremendous gift, at the very least to the Christian. Because I know that as a Christian, I can read the gospel account. I can begin to grasp. I can try to use my imagination about what Christ endured for me and to cover my sin. But seeing the depiction on film is as close as I believe I will ever get to the experience that those people had in Jerusalem who stood at the foot of the cross with Christ. So though I was dreading going to see a movie that was explicitly violent and that was filled with blood and showed so much pain and suffering for the character, for the historical figure of Jesus Christ, I really felt that if I was willing to accept his sacrifice and accept what it meant for my life and my salvation, that I needed to go and sit and watch it and take this opportunity, the best opportunity I've been afforded so far, to really enter into what Christ suffered for me.
Back on the subject of the war in Iraq, it's gone on for more than a year now. And there are people who are becoming impatient, fatigued. They don't like hearing slow but steady body count. How do you account for this impatience? If we look at it in terms of other conflicts we've been involved in, it hasn't gone on that long.
No, it certainly hasn't. And the president in his news conference on Tuesday evening looked at the press corps and said, I know this feels like it's been a long time, but it's only been about a year. And when we look at other things, whether it was our war for independence or the World War II, other major conflicts that have stretched on for many, many long years, it seems that the American people have really lost a lot of their capacity for patience, taking the long view. And it's a little disheartening that with so much warning in advance that the war on terror was going to be a long haul, that it appears that many of our fellow citizens have decided that the long haul should be about 12 months. And I think there's very little that's been accomplished of note in a 12-month period of time as you look over the course of history.
Amy, one last question, only about 30 seconds to answer. I remember well Ronald Reagan talking about the evil empire of the former Soviet Union. George W. Bush very quickly coined the phrase after 9/11, the axis of evil. Are they overstating the case?
No, they are not. And I personally am very glad that God has put leaders in place that see this battle for what it is.
Amy White, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
That's Amy White, corporate and political speechwriter. I think she's going to be on Donnybrook sometime soon, maybe even tonight. You might want to tune in to Channel 9 Donnybrook this evening and see whether or not Amy's there. She appears there on occasion. She's author of a column in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch titled Don't Turn Away. You can read it at stltoday.com, stltoday.com. That's Amy White. Now, yesterday I had an opportunity to talk with Adrian Campo Flores. He is Miami Bureau Chief for Newsweek Magazine, and he did an article in the most recent Newsweek on Christian nightclubs. It's called Get Your Praise On. I began by asking him how he would describe the phenomenon of Christian nightclubs.
Well, you know, they are clubs that we're starting to see in greater numbers now. They've been around for a number of years, but in just sort of isolated spots. But they have, many of them have all the appearances of a regular nightclub, you know, sound and light systems and bar looking areas and, you know, tables and chairs set up and a dance floor in some of them. But they're often set up as ministries. Sometimes they're tied to a particular church in the area. They're often run as nonprofits, and their purpose is to create a venue where Christians can gather and listen to music and enjoy themselves, and yet not be surrounded by what they consider some of the more pernicious influences of regular nightclubs. So there's no alcohol, there's no smoking. The music is, by and large, in some places it's exclusively Christian. Others are a little looser about that and will mix it up a little bit more. And in some instances, they'll even offer church services on some nights.
Are they generally located in, I'm from Dallas originally, and there's a club district in Dallas down near downtown. Are they generally in that location in the big cities?
There are many that are, and actually one of the ones in Dallas is in the Deep Ellum section of Dallas, which has a number of bars and clubs, all, you know, by and large secular. And the one that I spent quite a bit of time at was in Minneapolis, also in the Warehouse District there, which is you know, where weekend partiers will go hang out in the bar scene. There's one in Bakersfield that's also located in an area that has a number of bars and restaurants around. So you do have many that are located in these spots. In others, there are a little bit more off the beaten track. Often it's, you know, it's a funding issue. It's kind of expensive to open up a club in some of these areas. So if you're just getting started and you don't quite have the financial backing, you might have to choose an off the beaten track place.
What did you find was the appeal for the people who patronize these Christian nightclubs?
What I heard repeatedly is that they found that it was a safe place. I spoke to a number of club goers who felt that, you know, come the weekend they didn't really have an option. They had been raised in such a manner that they didn't really feel comfortable being in a nightclub setting. Or they used to party a little too hard and then were saved and didn't want to be exposed to that environment because of the, you know, the possibility of falling back. So in a venue like this, they know that they're going to be surrounded by mostly like-minded people. They're going to be in a setting where they don't have to worry about, you know, for instance, for women, they don't have to worry so much about the meat market element of some nightclubs. And you know, they feel like it's an environment that's going to be inclusive, inviting, and a place where they could potentially develop friendships.
Is there any evidence of crossover patronage between the regular nightclub crowd, the people who are going out drinking, hopping from place to place, and these Christian nightclubs?
Yeah, that's a good question. I did come across a little of that. You know, obviously, if you're located in a setting where you have a lot of other clubs around, you're going to get some of the foot traffic that's going to go by. I spoke to one gentleman who actually used to work at a club across the street from the one that I visited in Minneapolis. It was actually a club that used to be owned by Prince. And he, you know, was curious about it, walked in one day. He was going through a particularly hard time in his life, you know, realized that it was an environment that maybe was healthy for him, and he slowly, you know, it grew on him, and he became more and more open to it, and now he's, you know, he regularly goes, he even volunteers there, and you know, he's sort of, you know, now he's a local there. And I think that I don't think that happens a lot, but based on the interviews that I did, it does happen sometimes.
We're talking with Ari Ocampo Flores. He's Miami bureau chief for Newsweek magazine. He's authored an article in the latest issue of Newsweek titled Get Your Praise On. We're talking about Christian nightclubs. Arian, are they profitable? You mentioned that some of them operate as nonprofits.
Yeah, that's a very tough challenge for these clubs, because they really, it's very tough for them to be profitable. The club that I visited in Minneapolis is on a 5-year plan now. They're probably about a year into it to become self-sustaining. And so they rely on a mixture of donations, some subsidy that's provided by the church that they're connected to open up the venue. They relied on loans to do it, and they're working on paying those back. From my conversations with the gentleman who started the one of the clubs in Dallas, that is a self-sustaining operation. There's another one in Nashville too that according to them, is also self-sustaining. So it's not a place where, you know, club owners are going to make a lot of money. It's a place where they're going to have to struggle to get by. But I think once they're established and they have, you know, mainline acts that are coming in that are popular among Christians, you know, if they cobble together sales from food and drinks at the bar together with ticket sales, they can usually squeeze by.
Sounds like the beginning of a bad joke. But if someone walks into this particular bar, what are they going to see that's going to Will they be immediately be able to tell that they are in a Christian nightclub, no booze, no cigarette smoke? Or is the goal to, in a sense, bring people in, not knowing initially when they walk in the doors, that they're in a Christian venue?
I don't think it's you know, there's necessarily an ulterior motive in trying to sort of lure you in. I think what it is they want to create a place that kind of bridges the tension between, you know, for evangelical Christians wanting to be with, you know, people of like mind and yet also wanting to, you know, participate in popular culture. There aren't, you know, you walk in and there are no overt religious symbols. You're not going to see scripture quoted on walls. You know, no one's going to hand you a Bible the minute you walk in the door. You will be able to tell, you know, instantly when you go to order a drink at the bar that, you know, vodka is not an option. And if you hear the music and pay attention to the lyrics, you'll notice that the lyrics are going to be Christian themed. And I know that the doorman at the you know, the club that I visited will tell patrons or potential patrons at the door, you know, they'll tell them, look, this is a no smoking, no drinking club, just so you know, if it looks like these are people that aren't familiar with the club. So it's you know, it's not the kind of thing that you know, they hit you over the head with as soon as you walk in, but you will realize pretty quickly.
I'm also curious about the church services that you say some of these Christian nightclubs hold during the week or on a weekend. How does what happened during that time differ from the regular nightly fare at the Christian nightclub?
Well, there's a range of different approaches to it. At the venue that I visited, they'll have church services two nights a week. I was at the Sunday evening service. And they start off with, they have a house band that plays, you know, a full band. I mean, they have all the instruments, three vocalists. And they'll sing a series of Christian songs. It's sort of uplifting music. People are gathered on the dance floor, but they arrange tables and chairs there. And then they will have a pastor that comes out and, you know, he'll deliver a message. Maybe lasts about 45 minutes or so. At the end, he will ask if there are any people in the audience who feel like they are not certain that they're going to be heading to heaven, and you know, invites the congregation to say a prayer of salvation for them, and they'll hand them Bibles afterwards, and then they'll wrap up with another couple of songs from the house band, and you know, kind of get the flock fired up. People will stand up and sort of sway to the music. There's no real dancing at that point, but it's a very non-traditional approach to it.
One final question, Arian. How late are they open? Most clubs in major cities are open till 2 or 3 or sometimes even 4 o'clock in the morning. Did you Did you discover that in the course of your research?
Yeah, they'll stay up and just as late as the other clubs, and you know they're not going to have quite the you know the traffic that other clubs will get late into the night. But you know on a Saturday night they'll stay. You know the one I visited to will stay. They had a concert act up until about midnight, and then a DJ that came on and played until about 2 a.m. And there was you know a few hearty souls left at that hour.
Arian Campo-Flores is Miami Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine. He's authored a story in the latest issue of Newsweek titled Get Your Praise On, talking about Christian nightclubs. Arian, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Now, you can go online and you can read the article that Arian has written called Get Your Praise On. It's at newsweek.com, newsweek.com. We're going to go to a break. When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with Aaron Wolf of Chronicles Magazine about neoconservatives and Christian Zionism. What happened yesterday? Well, the president, he decided to make a major shift in American policy about Israel and Palestine. He's going to recognize Israel's right to retain some West Bank settlements and, in effect, deny the so-called right of return to Palestinians. We'll be talking with Aaron Wolf about that for the remainder of the first hour of Issues, Etc. when we come back from this break. Christian nightclubs, you know, as the line between the Christian nightclub, the entertainment venue, and the Christian church gets blurrier and blurrier, you wonder where either one is headed. Churches that on Sunday morning seem more like nightclubs, nightclubs that on Saturday night seem more like churches. You wonder whether or not it would probably be advisable for the line to remain a little bolder than it is. We'll see how that goes. There are churches that on Sunday morning, you might get the impression trying to open a nightclub, or I guess in their case, they'd call it a Sunday morning club. Whether we're gathering together on Saturday night or Sunday morning, if we gather as the church, we gather around God's Word, not around our common morals, not around our common taste in music, not around our common dance steps, but around God's Word and the gifts of his sacraments. That's something the church ought to remain. When we come back, we'll be talking with Aaron Wolf of Chronicles Magazine about Christian Zionism.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Why do you go to church? To thank and praise God? To get some spiritual motivation for a weary work week? To obey God's command, remember the Sabbath day? But is worship primarily about what we do, or is it about God's service to us? Worship is the subject of our Issues, Etc. book of the month for April. They Will See His Face. It's published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. They Will See His Face costs $12.99 plus shipping and handling, 1-800-325-3040. You can also order this book online at issuesetc.org. Just click the What's New section. They Will See His Face is a must-read for the worship wards. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. They Will See His Face, our Issues, Etc. book of the month for April.
Now this Global Minute focuses your prayers on Christian women in India who have almost 24 girls in their families. The songs, sights, and talking of up to 23 girls living in family-style homes fills the campus of the Rambabai Mukti Mission in Pune, India. Each home has a matron mother who is responsible for helping the girls cook, get ready for school, and she prays for each one. One mother named Jyoti felt overwhelmed with all the activities. She was worried about being a poor example to the children in her care, but then she prayed and God encouraged her. Many girls who come to the Mukti homes are rescued from poverty, fear, and a background of idol worship. Mukti is a place where they can learn to be free in Christ. Pray for God to give the Mukti staff joy in their burdens. Get a free newsletter from Mukti and discover breakthroughs among India's children. Call 1-800-268-0461. That's 800-268-0461.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Jesus says, "Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's." Today, we are getting rendered. Through most of Western history, people have been wary of left-handers. The Greek word for the left is translated well-named, a euphemism to ward off the evil thought to be associated with a left hand. The Romans were more blunt. The Latin word for the left hand is sinister. Today we often regard government as sinister, especially when uncle reaches deep into our pockets. Interestingly, in theology, the government is sometimes referred to as the kingdom of the left. The church is God's kingdom of the right. That reference is not a slam. While no form of government or administration is perfect, the Bible makes clear that God intends government to bless our earthly life. Government, says Romans 13, is God's servant for your good. So today we render unto Caesar, which means to give government their due, and maybe more than their due. Render also means to melt down fat by heating, like rendering lard. A good thing if today's 1040 burns down our expectations of government to the lean truth. Rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. I'm Dale Meyer.
Hi, this is Paul Clayton. I bring you news and information, inspirational Christian favorites, and conversations with great guests Monday through Friday on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO. Plus, short features like, By the Way, Our Thought for the Day from the Reverend Paul Devanteer, Front Porch Parenting with Dr. Mary Mance Simon, commentary from Dr. Dale Meyer, It's the Meyer Minute, plus Your Creation Moment. Features on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO.
Christian support of Israel is based upon the scriptures. It's based upon the covenants that God has made with Israel and the Jewish people that are still valid. They have not been replaced. Israel has not been replaced by Christians or the church. The church, rather, has been absorbed or been engrafted, as the Apostle Paul says, into Israel.
That's Pastor James Hutchins. He's president of Christians for Israel. Now, he's reacting to President Bush's action yesterday when he recognized Israel's right to retain some West Bank settlements as part of a peace accord with the Palestinians. And he also formally endorsed Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's plan to withdraw from Gaza and parts of the West Bank. He called the plan historic and courageous. Now, this does represent a major shift in American policy, and it's already angering many Arabs. On Wednesday night, Mr. Bush said that Israel should not have to return to its pre-1967 borders, that the Palestinians and the descendants who lost their land to Israel in 1948 should eventually be settled in a Palestinian state, not back in Israel. And in that sense, the president has effectively ruled out anything of what they call a right to return for Palestinians. Okay, beyond the fact that this represents a major shift in our foreign policy vis-a-vis Israel, what does it mean? Why are we supporting Israel as an ally? There are obviously theological reasons. The New York Times noted that the president's evangelical base is pretty happy with this decision. They've been worried about the president's roadmap for peace for a long time. We're going to be talking with Aaron Wolf during this half hour of Issues, etc. Aaron Wolf is assistant editor of Chronicles magazine, based in Rockford, Illinois. Christian Zionism and neoconservatism is our topic for this 25 minutes. If you'd like to join us, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Aaron Wolf, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
Aaron, was what we heard from Pastor Hutchins there at the open of the program of Christians for Israel, is that typical of Christian Zionism?
Yes, it is. There is a theological component to just about every aspect of this terrible conflict in the Middle East. And the side that supports unilaterally Israel has this element to it that we call Christian Zionism or dispensationalism, that believes that all of the land that God ever gave to the nation of Israel is eternally theirs, and that anyone who stands in the way is standing in the way of Almighty God.
Now, there are those who also support the kind of move made yesterday by the president with Ariel Sharon, but not for theological reasons. You have labeled this as neoconservatism. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, the ideology of neoconservatism has been with us since the 1960s, but it's just now become prominent. particularly the left, in the left-wing press, has begun to denounce the Bush administration as being influenced by neoconservatism. Now, this is something that some of us on the old right have been saying for a long time, that there is an ideology that really is the brainchild of ex-Trotskyist Jewish thinkers such as Irving Kristol and Norman Podhoretz, who have really grown in power over the last few decades to exert enormous influence over what we call the conservative movement. They were prominent during the Reagan years, but they are particularly influential over the Bush White House. Now, their idea of conservatism is sort of different from the traditional sort of Jeffersonian conservatism in America. Their idea really is of a government that is a strong central government and that goes out into the world spreading democracy. We hear that phrase from time to time in the press, spreading democracy, or even the spread of benevolent global hegemony. And that idea is really formed by those who used to follow Trotsky, and yet it's been revamped into the guise of, I guess, what the neoconservatives used to call Victorian morality, or what today we call family values. In other words, they think that in order to have a strong central government, that the people must be a generally moral people. And so the neoconservatives attract the attention of the Christian right through their publications like the Weekly Standard and even National Review, which has come to be dominated by neoconservative ideologues, so that the Christian right, in its support of Israel and in opposing abortion and homosexual rights, is really beholden to the ideology of the neoconservatives, even though they themselves aren't particularly religious, but rather follow this sort of secularist ideology.
Now, let's make it clear here for the sake of our listeners, Aaron, that on issues of abortion, on issues of family values, you have no real gripe with neoconservatives or the Christian right. But on the issue of a support for Israel, you want to raise some major questions with both of those groups that have found common cause in kind of an uncritical support for Israel's aims here. Tell us about that.
Yes, that's right. Well, in terms of the moral issues I mentioned, absolutely. I can't imagine any Christian who wouldn't be absolutely opposed to abortion or any of the so-called homosexual rights, even the so-called civil unions that are being touted today. I do tend to disagree with some of the proposals that are put forth by neoconservatives and their followers that seek solutions to those moral problems through federal amendments and methods that really give more power to what I believe is kind of a corrupt federal government. But having said that, I do agree with them wholeheartedly that these are tremendous moral blights in our society. But with regard to support for the state of Israel, let me be clear there, too. I certainly don't oppose the idea that the Israelis should have their own state and government, that they should be free of terror, that they don't have a right to exist where they currently exist. What I do have a problem with is the ideology of Zionism that has its so-called Christian form and also its secular form. That says that God has given them this right, or that history has given them the right to this land, and not just where they currently occupy, but an increasing amount of land stretching into the West Bank. You know, you mentioned that President Bush agreed with Ariel Sharon that the West Bank, that the Israelis would pull out of settlements in the West Bank. But let's be clear about that, too. These are basically four fringe settlements in the West Bank where the Israelis sought and got U.S. backing to remain in 140 settlements in the West Bank, even though the population comparison is
is incredible, that there are millions of Palestinians who live in this area, and only in the tens of thousands of Jews that live in this area.
Okay, first of all, so we can kind of lay the groundwork, you mentioned the Weekly Standard and you mentioned National Review, that when I used to read National Review back in its days of William F. Buckley, I don't think would have been classified as neoconservative so much. But give us some names of some folks in the neoconservative camp that our listeners might be familiar with. And then, if you would, we've talked about they have common cause. What are the real differences that may not be recognized by either of these camps, neoconservatives or Christian Zionists?
Okay. The current editor of National Review is a man named David Frum. He is a Jewish neoconservative ideologue, recently wrote a book along with Richard Perle, who until February was an advisor to the Pentagon, called An End to Evil, How to Win the War on Terror. David Frum is the one who wrote President Bush's Axis of Evil speech and coined that phrase. Some other names, I mentioned Richard Perle. He was part of the Bush cabinet. Paul Wolfowitz is an avowed neoconservative. Some of the leading lights are Norman and his son John Podhoretz. These are people that our listeners might not be as much familiar with, but yet they're editors of magazines like Commentary and the National Interest, very influential in the realm of foreign policy. Douglas Faith, who is currently Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, is a neoconservative and has been an advisor to the Likud party, which is Ariel Sharon's party. In fact, many of these neoconservatives hold dual citizenship in Israel and the United States. William Kristol, the son of Irving Kristol, William Kristol is the current editor, and he's the founder of the Weekly Standard. So these are some names. Also, William Bennett. It's a mistake, I think, to say that all neoconservatives are also Jewish. They're not, though the ideology kind of comes from a particular Jewish perspective on, as I said, Trotsky. William Bennett, the author of the compiler of the Book of Virtues, he is a neoconservative. Gene Kirkpatrick, a neoconservative, supporter of the New Deal and that type of politic. So, these are some names. And you had another question.
Yeah, the other question was, let's put it in this form, if we could. I was talking about the real differences between neoconservatives and Christian Zionists, although they have a common cause in Israel and other issues as well. Neoconservatives, they don't largely support the dispensational theology of Christian Zionism. Do they use Christian Zionists?
Absolutely they do. Although there have been a few who have defected because they felt that they had to hold their nose to do it. But most of the neoconservatives do make use of the Christian Zionists. And this is one reason why the whole ideology of Christian Zionism bothers me, because I'm afraid that these folks don't realize, these faithful Christians in many respects don't realize, that there are people pulling levers of power who are very happy to stoke up the fires of these folks, and yet they really don't believe, they're not Christians, many of them aren't even observant Jews. What they do believe in is the idea of the progress of an elect nation or a chosen nation in world politics that has power, whose mission is to spread global democracy.
How much do you think President Bush has been influenced by both Christian Zionists and neoconservatives? You mentioned some of the neoconservatives in his cabinet, but what about Christian Zionists?
I think that he's influenced by them insofar as Karl Rove and the Bush White House know that they have to rally the support of the Christian right, which is by and large Christian Zionists, in order to gain election. And I think that it's no coincidence that now that the campaign is starting to ramp up, that this historic and I think disastrous announcement was made the other day. It's not only is it really a defiance to the Palestinian people, who weren't even brought to the table to discuss with Ariel Sharon and the president the terms of this settlement. Rather, it's just being sort of imposed on them. But there's a risk here of alienating the other members of the quartet that came up with the so-called roadmap, which even in the neoconservative press was being denounced as a failure in the last few months. Just skimming over the Russian press today and European press, there's a lot of dissatisfaction with the way things were handled and with the outcome of this recent meeting with Ariel Sharon, particularly in light of the fact that we're just a month away from, it's just a month after Sharon approved the assassination of the founder of Hamas, the Sheikh Ahmad Yassin, who admittedly is a Muslim, a radical, someone who has done tremendous damage to the political situation in Israel and Palestine, but someone who wasn't posing a direct threat as a quadriplegic and a man in his 60s, returning from prayers at the mosque and was hit by a missile, and he and two of his sons and four others were killed there in Gaza. This, of course, outraged the Arab world, and unfortunately, I think from a foreign policy point of view, plays right into the mentality of Islam, of jihad, and basically underscores the fact that our foreign policy in this realm is exactly backward.
We're talking about Christian Zionism and neoconservatism. Aaron Wolf is our guest, assistant editor of Chronicles Magazine, that's published in Rockford, Illinois. Now, if you'd like to comment on this, we're going to be taking your phone calls on this issue in the next hour during an entire hour of open lines, also hearing a little bit more from the Christian Zionists reacting to President Bush's decision to basically reverse American foreign policy and to go a different direction, Ariel Sharon's direction, in Israel and the plan for peace in the Holy Land. Aaron Wolf is our guest. Aaron, oh, by the way, our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Aaron, let's put it in a nutshell on both of these groups. What is wrong with Christian Zionism?
Christian Zionism implies to Christian people that they have to accept an unbiblical doctrine that was never heard of in the history of the church until about 200 years ago, and that is that Israel, as an ethnic people, as a race, is still part of God's plan, that God in the last days is going to bring about sort of a revival of what they call Judaism in Israel, and that this is something that all Christians must support. It's contrary to the gospel because it gives many Jews the false impression that they need not accept the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ by faith for their salvation, but rather that they might just adhere to their what they believe is their ancient religion, which really isn't, because the religion of the Old Testament was a religion that looked to the coming of Christ Jesus, whose resurrection we just celebrated, and so therefore these folks are left with sort of a mixed theology that says, yes, we must believe in Jesus, but maybe the Jews don't need to, at least not in the way that we do, but that we must all support Israel as Christians. That's simply not scriptural. And I'm sorry, was there another question?
Well, again, in a nutshell, what's wrong with neoconservatism?
Well, neoconservatism I critique more from a political point of view, in that the founding of this country was not really a democracy, but a republic, and with concentric spheres of authority. And yes, our country was founded by deists, but there was a strong Christian element in this country, and there was a strong recognition in the past that the power of people in government ought to be limited. The neoconservative political vision is not one of limited power, but is one of a New Deal Rooseveltian centralized state. In addition to that, I don't think that any nation really has the mandate, whether it's from God or from history or however you want to put it, to go out and spread its ideology in the rest of the world, be that democracy or whatever. How the neoconservatives define democracy is kind of foreign to the thinking of our founding fathers in this country, who wouldn't have imagined the idea of us sending our military overseas to effect what the neoconservatives like to call regime change. Instead, we remember the words of George Washington, who talked about staying away from foreign entanglements. And so that I oppose the ideology of neoconservatism primarily on political grounds, but also I disagree with their willingness to make use of and to dissemble before Christian conservatives, Christian Zionists, and get their support in order to achieve their often very secular goals for the state of Israel.
What happens when your magazine Chronicles questions neoconservatism? What kind of feedback do you get?
Well, unfortunately, we get a lot of negative feedback, especially from the sort of the mainstream press, although lately that's changed a little bit with the left sort of decrying the neoconservative influence in Washington. But the word anti-Semite comes up quite a bit, which I think is absurd, especially since we have a number of Jewish figures who share our point of view and work for us. Paul Gottfried, one of our editors, Rabbi Jacob Neusner, Leon Hadar. These are Jewish people who simply disagree with the neoconservative ideology. And it's also interesting to note that there are most of the Jews in America, if you just poll them, I think the last number I saw was something like 55% disagree with this neoconservative ideology, and certainly Jews in Israel do. It's very interesting, and we have a piece by Leon Hadar in our June issue coming up, talking about how if you talk about neoconservatives in the American press, New York Times, Washington Post, etc., that you're labeled an anti-Semite. But in Haaretz, in Jerusalem newspapers, a robust political debate occurs, and there are plenty of Jews there who denounce the ideology of neoconservatism.
How much support has the United States given to the state of Israel, the modern state of Israel, and why?
Well, since 1948, we're looking at a figure of somewhere around $100 billion. We're up to $3 billion a year now, and that's just talking about grants. We're also frequently engaged in loan guarantees and in throwing our weight around at the World Bank to make sure that the Israel. In fact, I think Sharon asked for a $5 billion loan just in this recent trip to Washington. Some have said that in current U.S. dollars, this figure translates to about $240 billion. Of the $3 billion that we give to Israel out and out every year now, about two-thirds of that is used for military functions.
A couple more questions very quickly. What have we gotten in return?
Well, some particularly Republicans, have gained a tremendous amount of power and won elections. Although John Kerry went on record today as saying that he supported everything that came out of the meeting with Sharon and Bush. We have gained an ally in the region, but what have we lost? We have lost other potential allies, and more than that, we've, I think, fan the flames of Islamic terrorism. Specifically, this idea, which I really, when I was mentioning how we have our foreign policy, I think, backward on this, the idea that Sheikh Ahmad Yassin used in his founding of Hamas was to take essentially a secularist Islamic people and transform them into militant Muslims, not all of them, but certainly many of them, galvanized by groups like Hamas. And what they do is they appeal to the theology of the Quran, where the whole world is divided into two specific regions, the Dar al-Islam, the realm of Islam, and the Dar al-Harb, which is the realm of war. So a true Islamic, we say fundamentalist, but just somebody who believes his Quran, believes that if you don't live in land governed by Sharia, Islamic law, then you live in the realm of war.
We've only got about 15 seconds here.
So Yassin galvanized the whole suicide bomber movement by appealing to the Quran.
Very quickly, with only about 10 seconds, is there freedom of religion in the modern state of Israel?
Not really, and the extreme right there wants to take away even more of the freedom that Christians have. Sometimes Christians are deported from Palestinian lands, and the Israelis just send them right back. They're very hostile toward Christianity in Israel.
Aaron Wolf, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you.
Aaron Wolf is assistant editor for Chronicles Magazine, published in Rockford, Illinois. You can check out their website, chroniclesmagazine.org. ChroniclesMagazine.org. Open lines when we come back, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. So if we're talking about several hundred billion dollars in real modern-day terms, what have we gotten in return? How much use is an ally that can't fight for us in the region where they are the ally? We won't let them fight for us. We'll talk about that during Open Lines when we come back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.